locomotion. And ever since we've been standing on the ground, it's been difficult to resist the temptation of grabbing a branch overhead and putting our chins up over it. And you should be strong enough to do that. The pull-up is not only a good exercise, but also a very good indicator of upper body strength. If you can't do very many chin-ups, your press and bench press will increase as you get stronger on this very important exercise. And that is why it's the only ancillary exercise included in the novice program. Chin-ups and pull-ups are most famous for their effects on the lats, the latissimus dorsi muscles. But they're equally important for the other muscles of the upper back. The rhomboideus, the teres major, the serratus group, and the rotator cuff muscles, as well as the forearms and hands. Chin-ups even work the pecs a little if done from a diligent dead hang, and abs if enough reps are used to get them fatigued. In this book, the term pull-up refers to the version of the exercise with the hands prone, while chin-up, or just chin, refers to the version done with supine hands. The major and significant difference between the two is the biceps' involvement in the chin-up and the lack of it in the pull-up. The addition of the biceps makes chin-ups a little easier than pull-ups, as well as adding the aesthetic elements of arm work to the movement. Pull-ups are harder, and they probably emphasize lat involvement more, since the absence of the biceps means that something else must do its work. Because of the pronation, pull-ups also might aggravate the elbows for a lifter who is not very flexible. The prone grip shortens the distance between the grip and the shoulders. The supine grip tends to increase this distance if you don't pay attention to keeping it close. So the pull-up might seem easier for some people if they stay too far away from the bar on chin-ups. Once your strength permits, you can add weights to strict chins and pull-ups for increased workloads. The more your trunk moves, the more trunk muscles are involved, and this is why abs can get sore. But any version of the chin-up or pull-up where the whole body moves is better than the machine version of the exercise, the lat pull-down, in which only the arms move. Chin-ups are a better introductory exercise than pull-ups, and perhaps a better exercise altogether because they involve more muscle mass. We'll use a bar set at slightly above the level of the upreached fingertips while we're standing flat on the floor. When you're hanging from this level, your toes should just barely touch the floor. This, of course, is an ideal height, and your equipment may be lower or higher, depending on your situation. The crossbar at the top of a power rack works perfectly, as might a bar set high in the rack pins. If you're fortunate enough to train in a gym, enlightened enough to have provided chin-up bars, enjoy them, because they're not common in commercial gyms. A bar that is 1 1/4 inches in diameter feels the best for chin-ups in most people's hands, unless your hands are unusually small. But it's not hard to make do, and most training facilities will have a place for the innovative trainee to chin. In the chin-up grip, your palms are facing you, about shoulder width apart. Grip width can vary several inches, depending on elbow flexibility. The more easily the hands can supinate, the wider the grip can be. The wider grip increases supination and biceps involvement. The wider the grip is, the greater the external rotation of the humerus is. The closer the grip is, the more internally rotated the humerus, the more abducted the scapulas, and the less involved the scapula retractors and posterior delts are. Grip width may not be a practical variable to manipulate due to the joint stress it causes at the extremes of wide and narrow, but since grip width affects the way the shoulders interact with the load, some shoulder injuries can be affected by grip width. A shoulder width grip is good for our purposes and presents no problems for most people. Chalk makes for a better grip and fewer calluses, and using it is necessary. A knurled or rough bar destroys the hands and therefore adversely affects the rest of your training. The movement itself is obviously simple. Take your grip and pull your elbows down, which results in your leaving the ground. Each rep starts from a full stretch at the bottom, with elbows straight and scapulas stretched up, and is complete when your chin clears the bar. A more honest approach might be to touch your chest to the bar, but we'll count the rep if your chin clears the bar with your face forward and your head not laid back too far. Try to stay as close to the bar as possible. The gold standard rep is done from a dead hang, with a slight pause at the fully stretched out bottom. It is terribly common to see partial chins, which should be called foreheads or nose-ups, and are usually accompanied by less than straight elbows at the bottom. For a high rep set, you can use a stretch reflex at the bottom as long as the bottom is actually the bottom. In this case, breathing will consist of a quick breath at the top of each rep. For a higher rep set to failure, 12 or more reps, for example, you'll find that the first two-thirds to three-fourths of the set will be rebounded, and the last reps will be done from a dead hang as you take a couple of breaths between reps at the bottom. The same rules apply to pull-ups if you decide to do them. Cutting the rep short at either the top or the bottom is as bad as squatting high. The primary benefit of the exercise lies at the ends of the movement. The bottom stretches out the lats, and the first shrug of the stretched up scapulas down is all lats and upper back muscles. The finish at the top is biceps and triceps, and a completed rep means that you've moved your body a constant, measurable distance through space. Each rep is therefore the same, and your effort becomes quantifiable, not just flailing around in the air. But what if you can't do a complete chin-up? Lower the bar a little, or raise the floor, possibly an easier thing to do, artificially, and use a jump to get the movement started until you're strong enough to do it strict. Be sure to lower yourself under control to get the most out of the negative, and always use only as much jump as is necessary. Or you can use resistance bands in the rack, stretched across the pins until you're strong enough to do the movement with only a jump. The ability to do an honest chin-up may be beyond some novices who are at a heavier body weight. And if you cannot do a good, strict rep at all, it will be best to wait until your lats and arms are stronger from deadlifts and presses, or until your body fat comes down enough to permit you to handle your body weight effectively on the bar. Kipping chin-ups and pull-ups are gymnastic derivatives of the jumping version. The kipping version uses the momentum of a swing slightly preceding the pull, when the swing is converted into an upward roll of the hips, translating the swing energy into upward movement. The kip distributes the movement over more muscle mass, using the abs, hip flexors, and lower back in addition to the lats and arms, so that more muscle mass is used in the exercise and more reps can be done. Strict chins and pull-ups concentrate the effort on less muscle mass and work it harder. Kipping chin-ups and pull-ups have proven themselves to be a useless way to strengthen the strict versions of the movement. And in the absence of enough strength to do the strict versions, they have proven to be dangerous for shoulder health. Resist the temptation to jump on any bandwagon that encourages short-term gratification at the expense of long-term progress. Many people who can do 15 kipping reps cannot do 2 dead hangs and have made no progress on their dead hangs since they started cheating the movement with a kip. If you want to use kipping pull-ups or chin-ups in a conditioning workout, make sure your shoulders and arms are strong enough to do 8 to 10 strict reps first so that you don't hurt yourself chasing a meaningless number. If you cut this important corner, shoulder surgery may be the only reward you receive. Weighted chins and pull-ups are an excellent source of heavy, non-pressing work for the upper body. Placed or suspended from a chain on a belt or a dumbbell can be held in the feet if not much weight is used. A good rule of thumb is that when you can do 12 to 15 bodyweight reps, it's probably time to start doing some of the work weighted, possibly alternating higher rep bodyweight workouts with lower rep weighted workouts. Several sets across are appropriate for chins and pull-ups, either weighted, unweighted, or assisted. And many people have made steady linear progress by micro-loading their chins the same way they programmed the bench press and press by adding 1.5 to 2 pounds to 3 sets of 5 reps every workout. Try them all and see which works best for you. Dips. The parallel bar dip is a movement borrowed from gymnastics. It consists of supporting yourself by the arms between and above 2 parallel bars, lowering your body down, and then driving it back up. The dip is a good substitute for the bench press if it cannot be done for some reason, and is far superior to the decline bench press, which there is no good reason to do. If the lower pecs and triceps are the object of your desire, the apple of your eye, as it were, then dips are your exercise. They are better than the decline because, like any good exercise, they involve the movement of lots of your muscles, besides the lower pecs and triceps. In this case, dips involve the movement of your entire body. They're like push-ups in this respect. They're better than push-ups because they can be weighted and thus incrementally increased in load, and performed alone, where push-ups cannot be weighted conveniently without 2 people involved. The quality of an exercise increases with the involvement of more muscles, more joints, and more central nervous system activity needed to control them. The more of the body involved in an exercise, the more of these criteria are met. When the whole body moves, a more nearly ideal state is achieved with lots of muscles and nerves, controlling lots of joints, and the central nervous system keeping track of lots of different pieces of the body doing many different things, hopefully correctly. By this logic, push-ups are better than bench presses, since push-ups involve the movement and control of the entire body. But they are very difficult to do weighted, especially alone, because of the problems with loading the human body in this position. Were it possible, a good weighted push-up device would be in use today, but it's not. It has long been assumed that the bench press has solved that problem, when in fact it hasn't. The only thing moving in the bench press is the arms. So in this particular way, the bench is to the push-up what the lat pull-down is to the pull-up. But the bench does allow the same approximate movement to be loaded and has allowed many people to increase their push-up numbers without high-rep push-ups. Without adding weight, a fit person will find it difficult to train a pressing motion moving in the anterior direction without using very high reps, which are seldom appropriate for most training goals. Dips address both problems, allowing heavy weights to be used while the entire body moves during an upper body exercise. Unweighted dips are harder than push-ups because the whole body is moving, not just the part that isn't supported by the feet. And for the more advanced trainee, dips are very easy to use weighted by either hanging plates or other objects from a belt or by holding a dumbbell between the feet, an option which works well with only light weights, of course. The anterior aspect of the movement is provided by the slightly inclined torso position, a function of the fact that the forearms stay vertical during the whole movement. If the body's mass is to be evenly distributed relative to the position of the hands on the bars, that is half the mass in front of the hands and half of it behind the hands, then the body will have to assume an inclined position during the movement. There's enough angle to provide for a tremendous amount of pec involvement, using primarily the lower part of the muscle belly. And since the arms are operating downward relative to the upper body, The lats are also involved in the adduction of the humerus, adding even more muscle mass to the exercise. Heavy weights can be used in this exercise, and many powerlifters have used it to maintain bench strength while an injury heals, one that the bench aggravates but the dips do not. Dips can be used for unweighted high reps or weighted, just like the bench would be trained as a progressively loaded lift. The whole body effects are felt more as weight increases, with very heavy efforts producing fatigue throughout the trunk and arms. Dips are best done on a set of dip bars, stationed designed for this purpose. Most modern gyms do not have a set of parallel bars as might be found in a gymnastic studio or previously in most gyms. Dip station bars are usually 24 to 26 inches wide, and the most comfortable ones are made out of 1 1/4 or 1 1/2 inch pipe or bar stock. They're between 48 and 54 inches high, which is tall enough to allow the trainee's feet to completely clear the ground at the bottom of the dip. They really, really need to be stable, either attached to a wall or built with enough base that any possible amount of wobble during the movement will not tip the bars. A non-parallel station with the bars at a 30-degree angle allows for a variety of grip widths that more closely approximate the press, bench press, or jerk grip without adversely affecting the neutral hand orientation. But in a pinch, or in a motel room even, two chairs can serve as a dip station if they're stable when turned back to back. To perform dips, select your grip and jump up into a position on the bars with your elbows locked and chest up. Take a big breath and hold it. Start down by unlocking your elbows and leaning forward a little, and continue down until your shoulders are below your elbows. This position is easily identified by someone watching you. The humerus at the shoulder will dip below parallel. This criterion ensures a complete range of motion, plus a good stretch for the pecs. It also provides a way to judge the completeness of the rep, a way to quantify the work and compare performances between two people, thus serving the same purpose that the below parallel criterion does in the squat. Drive your body up out of the bottom stretched position until your elbows are locked out, raising your chest into position directly above your hands on the bar. Exhale at the top after finishing the rep. And when you need a breath, be sure to take it only when you're locked out at the top. Don't exhale during the rep. The pressure provides rib cage support that is important for effective control of the body while it's moving. The two most common errors in performing dips involve the completeness of the movement. Most people, when not being yelled at about it, will cut the depth off above parallel. They do this because it is easier to do a partial dip than it is a full dip, just as it's easier to do a partial squat. A partial dip does not carry the injury potential that a partial squat does. But partial dips are not as valuable as full range of motion dips for the same reason that half squats are less than adequate. They work less muscle mass. If you go to the trouble of loading a dip belt to do the exercise weighted and then cheat the depth, you're just wasting training time and kidding yourself about how strong you are, just like when you cheat any other exercise. Do your dips deep with a lighter weight if necessary, so you don't miss the actual benefit. The other problem is a failure to lock out the elbows at the top between reps. This is not the heinous crime that cutting off the depth is, because it's usually unintentional. Tired triceps don't always know that they are not completely contracted. The chest up position at the finish helps cue the elbow lockout because it pulls the mass of the upper part of the torso behind the hands so that the triceps can extend the elbows against a more evenly distributed load. And gentlemen, when you're doing weighted dips with a chain and a belt, be sure to arrange the chain and plates in such a way as to minimize the chance of damage to the important structures that are in unfortunate proximity here in the event of a loss of control or a swinging of a plate. Ring dips are best left to gymnasts or other people at lighter body weights who are not training primarily for strength. Ring dips are a dangerous movement for your shoulders, and weighted ring dips are stupid for anybody. It doesn't take very much lateral movement of the rings to place the shoulder joints in a position of such instability that it cannot be controlled. The shoulders can easily be impinged during a dip because the load is driving the humerus and AC joint together already, and the addition of lateral moment force to the configuration has resulted in many avoidable surgical repairs to many rotator cuffs. Do your shoulders a favor and just do your dips on bars. Barbell rows. First, let's get this out of the way. Barbell rows are not a substitute for power cleans. If you use them for this purpose, you have decided to omit a more important exercise in favor of an assistance exercise, an easier movement that does not provide most of the benefits of the more important basic exercise. I say this because of the prevalence of this substitution since the second edition of this book was published. Power cleans are one of the primary constituents of the program, and barbell rows, useful as they may be to intermediate and advanced lifters and to older people, are not primary constituents of the program. Now that this is out of the way, let's get one more thing out of the way. Most people associate rows with machines that place you in a position to do them. Cable rows or the machine version of the T-bar row are the most common. But the most valuable rowing exercise is the one that makes you assume the position and maintain it through the set. This way, you get the benefits of both moving the bar through the rowing motion and doing the stability work needed to hold your back in the right position to do the movement. As with all beneficial barbell training, the more work you have to do during the exercise, the better the exercise. So let's learn how to do a proper barbell row. Barbell rows start on the floor and end on the floor. Each and every rep, the bar does not hang from the arms between reps. Each rep is separated by a breath and a reset of the lower back, just like a deadlift. Starting from the floor enables the hamstrings and glutes to get the bar moving so that the lats and the scapular retractors can finish a heavier weight than they could from a dead hang in the arms. Done this way, the exercise works not only the lats, upper back, and arms, the muscles typically associated with rowing, but the lower back and the hip extensors as well. When you are rowing from the floor, the most critical factor in technique is the position of the lower back. The lumbar spine must be held in extension, just like it is in a deadlift, and for exactly the same reason. A major similarity between rows and deadlifts is the back angle changing as the bar comes off the floor. Like in a deadlift, the extending knees should be thought of as the first initiation of the movement pattern off the floor. And then the hip extensors contribute to the initial pull from the floor by raising the chest, using the locked back, and transmitting this force to the bar. The finish occurs as the elbows bend and slam the bar into the lower rib cage or belly area. The bar will leave the floor from a position directly below the scapulas, just as in a deadlift, and directly over the middle of the foot. But in a barbell row, unlike a deadlift, the back angle will never become vertical and will not rise much higher than the shoulders at about 15 to 20 degrees above horizontal. Approach the bar with a deadlift stance. Light weights can be pulled in a curved bar path to the belly. As you warm up, But as the weight gets heavier, standard pulling mechanics will prevail and the bar will operate vertically over the midfoot, just as it does in all heavy pulls. As weight is added, the bar will adjust itself to the correct position over the foot, whether you want it to or not. The grip width can vary quite a bit, but a grip that's about the same as the bench press width is perhaps the best place to start. With heavier weights, you can use a hook grip or straps, but you really shouldn't need to. Your eyes should be fixed on the floor a few feet in front of you. Don't look straight down, but don't try to look straight forward either, because doing so will extend your neck too much. Take a big breath, push the floor with your feet, and raise the bar from the floor with straight elbows to get it moving, and then continue bringing it up by bending your elbows and slamming the bar into the upper part of your belly. This movement leads with the elbows after the bar leaves the floor, and you should think about slamming your elbows into the ceiling. The most important part of the technique of the barbell row is the back position. The spine must be locked into extension, with the chest up and the lower back arched the whole time the bar is moving. After the bar contacts your belly, lower the bar back to the floor. Exhale, take a new breath, reset your back, and start the next rep. Don't attempt to hold the bar against your belly at the top or to lower the bar too slowly. The barbell row is like a deadlift in that the work is intended to be mainly concentric. But it's like a clean in that explosive power must be used to slam the bar into the belly. Since heavier weights will be essentially dropped, you'll want to use bumper plates for rowing, or rubber mats under your standard iron plates will work just fine. With light weights, you can perform rows with just your arms. But as you approach work set weights, knee and hip extension become much more important. Knees will be almost straight, just slightly unlocked, with your hips higher than they would have been in a deadlift before the bar moves up, which is essentially the same position used to start a stiff leg deadlift. The movement starts with your arms straight and your chest coming up, raising your back angle slightly as the bar leaves the floor, a movement performed with the hamstrings and glutes acting on the rigid lower back, which is held in isometric contraction by the erectors. This initial hip extension starts the weight up, and your elbows catch the momentum and carry the bar on up with a shoulder extension and scapula retraction. The lats, triceps, biceps, forearm muscles, posterior delts, and smaller muscles around the shoulder blades are the prime movers here at the top of the exercise. The trunk muscles that stabilize the spine enable the trunk to act as a rigid platform against which the force can be generated and through which the force off the floor can be transmitted. The hamstrings and glutes, after their initial action off the ground, act to anchor the pelvis and therefore the lower back during the final rowing motion generated by the upper body, receiving the momentum of the bar up off the floor. As is so often the case in complex human movement, muscles change actions during the course of the activity, starting off with one function and ending up with another, and the function of the hip extensors during the barbell row is a good example of this shift. Rows are not useful at weights so heavy that form is hard to maintain. The finished position when the bar touches the belly is controlled by some of the same factors that limit a clean, in that a weight that can be rowed correctly may be only 15 pounds lighter than a weight that cannot be rowed at all. A row that is not finished will not touch the belly, and a row that is not finished will not engage the range of motion at the top that is unique to this exercise, and thus it might as well be called a partial explosive stiff leg deadlift. This reason, sets of 5 or more reps are often used, since weights that can be rowed only for a triple probably can't be done correctly by most people anyway. The first few reps will use only a slight, maybe less than 10 degrees, amount of hip extension. But as the set progresses and the upper body becomes fatigued, more hip extension gets thrown in to get the reps finished. Remember, a finished rep touches the belly. Be sure to continue doing rows and not deadlifts. Your back should never get much above horizontal. And if your chest comes up too high on the last reps, the bar is hitting too low and it's moving too slow. The range of motion for the target muscles has shortened, and the weight is therefore too heavy. As the weight gets heavy, there will be a pronounced tendency to allow your chest to drop down to meet the bar, completing the rep from the top down instead of from the bottom up. When this chest drop becomes excessive, the weight is too heavy. And excessive is a rather subjective concept here. Someone might decide that no chest drop is allowable, in which case heavy weights cannot be used in the exercise. Or someone might decide that as long as the chest can be touched with the bar, the rep counts. I have decided that. This degree of variability is one of the things that distinguishes an ancillary exercise from a primary exercise. If a large degree of variability is inherent in the performance of an exercise, it cannot be judged effectively or quantified objectively. For this reason, the barbell row makes a very, very good ancillary exercise, but a poor contest lift. A variation on the standard barbell row is to supinate the grip, thus adding more biceps to the exercise. This reverse grip row can be irritating to the elbows in inflexible people. The rather extreme degree of external rotation of the humerus combined with the completely supine hand is irritating to the forearm muscles insertion points on the elbows when they're flexed with a heavy weight, even though this rotation is usually tolerated well for chin-ups. The reverse grip row can produce tennis or golfer's elbow very quickly. So if you decide to try this version of the movement, start with light weights and cautiously work up to your heavier sets the first time or two. Also be aware that this grip can produce proximal bicep tendon soreness. It will feel like a sore shoulder to you. If it shows up after supine grip barbell rows, that's probably what it is. Back extensions and glute ham raises. There are a couple of ancillary exercises that require special equipment but are useful enough to make it worth locating. The Roman chair is an old piece of gym equipment that can be found in one form or another in most training facilities. It was developed in the late 1800s by the famous physical culturist Professor Louis Attila Durlacher from a device known as the Roman column that served a similar function. The Roman chair is a very basic bench. Just as an aside, a bench has no parts that move during an exercise. A machine does. And a bench supports the trainee's shins or feet from the top while supporting the thighs from below, thus allowing the trainee to be in a horizontal position supported by his legs. You can use the Roman chair while facing up for abdominal work or while facing down for back work. Ab workouts done on this bench are called Roman chair sit-ups after the device. The back exercise has been for many years referred to as a hyperextension, although that term specifically refers to a position that most joints don't like to be placed in. So the exercise is therefore preferably termed simply a back extension. You may hear hyperextension used for the exercise from time to time, but it is losing its place as more people become familiar with the biomechanical terminology. The term hyperextension actually refers to an injury. The back extension is a very good way to directly work the spinal erectors using both concentric and eccentric contractions. The normal function of the trunk muscles is stabilization of the spine. Using an isometric contraction that allows little or no relative movement of the vertebra. But the trunk muscles can be strengthened by an active motion of the spine during this exercise, which functions like a reverse sit-up. The erectors extend the spine from a flexed position over a broad range of motion. The fact that the spine is extended in a position parallel to the floor is a function of the simultaneous hip extension, which the glutes, all of them, max, medius, minimus, hamstrings, and adductors perform in coordination with the spinal extension. You perform the back extension by assuming a face-down position in a Roman chair, with the middle of your thighs on the front pad, the back of your legs, the part just below the calves and just above the heels on the Achilles tendon, jammed up into the foot pad or roller pad, and your body held parallel to the floor. Keep your knees very slightly unlocked, but not bent, with just a little tension from the hamstrings protecting the knees from hyperextension. The movement is an eccentric spinal extension. Just let your chest drop down toward the upright of the bench till your torso is perpendicular to the floor, and then a concentric spinal extension raising the chest, followed by hip extension which kicks in the glutes and hamstrings, to finish the exercise with the torso parallel to the floor. It's important to lead up with the chest, making it draw the back into extension, a full arch at the top of the movement. It works the spinal erectors, the glutes, and the upper hamstring function. Now, the glute ham bench is a modified Roman chair that allows the back extension to be carried on up into a body weight leg curl in an exercise called a glute ham raise. Glute ham benches are becoming more popular as more people figure out the utility of the exercise. In the finished position of the glute ham raise, your torso will be vertical. This exercise thus includes all the elements of back extension, but with lots and lots more hamstring involvement. The modification that allows this added movement is a plate welded onto the frame right behind the foot roller. This plate gives the feet a place to push against, allowing a knee flexion to occur, which carries the torso and the thighs on up into the vertical position. The hamstrings can do this with the plate against the feet because they have the help of the gastrocnemius, which cannot contribute to knee flexion unless its proximal function is facilitated by having its distal function blocked against the plate. Muscles that cross two joints can affect movement around either joint. The proximal function is that which is performed by the joint closest to the center of the body, and the distal function is performed on the other end of the bone, the one furthest away. Most of the joints in the body are moved by muscles that also attach across another joint. The hamstrings are perhaps the most classic example because they both extend the hips and flex the knees. The glute ham raise causes them to do both. The gastroc is another example of this type of muscle. It attaches to the calcaneus, the heel bone, by the Achilles tendon, and attaches to the lateral and medial epicondyles of the femur behind the knee as it splits into right and left heads. The gastroc both extends the ankle in plantar flexion and flexes the knee. The other major calf muscle, the soleus, shares the Achilles tendon with the gastroc, but attaches proximally to the tibia, and therefore does not cross the knee joint. The glute ham bench takes advantage of this anatomy and gives the feet a surface to push against. The weight of the body out in front of the forward pad traps the heels against the roller, allowing the body to be levered up, while the tension of the calves holds the feet against the plate. The plate blocks the ankle extension so that the contraction of the gastrocs is transmitted up to the femoral origins across the knee, causing the knees to flex. The glute ham raise is essentially a back extension until the torso is parallel to the ground, where the hips have extended as well as the spine. Then the feet push the plate, and the knee flexion adds to the upward momentum generated by the back extension, carrying the torso on up to a vertical position, with the knees flexed at 90 degrees. the back and hips in extension, and the chest up. The glutes engage more strongly here than they do in a simple back extension. They help generate momentum through the transition between the back extension and the knee flexion. Depending upon the individual, the glutes might not particularly be perceptible as they work in the exercise. The trainee may not feel the glutes much because of the huge contribution of the hamstrings working over a much longer range of motion, and because the glutes contract very efficiently over a shorter distance, since their origin and insertion points are not that far apart. The poorer the strength of the athlete, especially with regard to the squat, the more noticeable the glutes will be in this exercise. And the poorer the strength, the less likely the trainee will actually be able to do an entire set of 10 or even complete a single rep, all the way to vertical. Glute ham raises are hard at first, but get easier very quickly as the movement pattern and the trainee's associated neuromuscular efficiency improve. The movement is performed in essentially the same way as a back extension until the spine reaches the full arched position, which must occur in a coordinated fashion or the timing will be off. The knees then kick in to finish raising the chest up all the way to vertical. The best cue for this is the chest. Think about raising your chest up fast and hard, and the hamstrings, calves, and glutes will do their job at the right time. The hands are held either crossed on the chest, the easier way, or with fingers locked behind the head, the harder way because more mass is further away from the hips. Glute hams like to be done at higher reps. 10 to 15 for 3 to 5 sets seems to work the best. In this exercise, you're lifting the part of your body that is in front of the pad with muscles located behind the pad. And the more mass there is in front of the pad, the harder the job is to do. Most glute ham benches are adjustable between the front and back pads for this reason, and the difficulty of the movement can be adjusted accordingly. Set the front pad back far enough to ensure your crotch clears the pad, for other obvious reasons, and to make the exercise hard enough for you to get enough work out of it. But be careful about setting the back pad so far forward that the front pad is too close to the knees. There must be sufficient distance between the back and front pad to protect the knees. This position does increase the difficulty, but it also dramatically increases the amount of shear force on the knees, which are, after all, only held together by the cruciate ligaments, the capsular ligaments, and muscular tension. More advanced lifters can carry weight behind the neck or on the chest to increase the work if necessary. It is much better to add load with weight than with leverage in this exercise. When your thighs slide or roll down the pads, you have allowed your knees to bend before you have completed the back extension. Remember, any time the knees bend, the hamstrings shorten. If you allow this to happen before you finish the back extension phase of the movement, then you have contracted the hamstrings without making them do any actual work since they haven't contributed to the lifting up of the torso, and you have placed them in a position of partial contraction where they cannot contribute a full contraction to the exercise after the back extension phase has finished. Don't let your knees slide down from the thigh pad before your chest is up and your hips are extended. This is the most common error people make, and it ruins the effect of the exercise. And for the same reason, do not do glute ham raises on a bench constructed with rollers for the front pad. My God! When you first start doing them, glute ham raises may be very hard. Typically, an untrained person cannot do a complete rep all the way up to vertical. This is just fine. Come up as high as you can for each rep of the set, even though that height will deteriorate as the set goes on. The exercise gets easier very fast, as mentioned before, primarily because you learn how to do it more efficiently very quickly. Within 6 or 7 workouts, most people can perform at least one complete rep all the way up to vertical. When you can do several sets all the way up, add load after a warm-up set by holding a plate on your chest or a light bar behind your neck. A good definition of functional exercise is a normal human movement that can be performed under a scalable, increasable load. By this definition, neither back extensions of any type nor sit-ups are functional exercises. Some people have trouble with them, taking the form of chronic back pain or a tendency to get repeated small back injuries. The normal function of all the muscles surrounding the spine is spinal stabilization, and the squat, press, and all pulling exercises from the floor provide plenty of work for these muscles by challenging their function along with those of the prime movers of the exercise. If you are an older lifter with a degree of the normal spinal degeneration that accompanies advancing age, you might decide that eccentric and concentric back work and flexion-based abdominal work causes more problems than they correct. If you are continually plagued with lower back injuries, eliminate all exercises involving spinal flexion and extension for a few weeks and see what happens to the injury frequency. Your abs and back muscles will remain strong from doing their primary jobs under the big barbell exercises, and you'll stop having injury problems that interfere with your training. Curls. Since you're going to do them anyway, we might as well discuss the right way to do curls. Barbell curls are performed to train the biceps, a muscle that commands an inordinate amount of attention from far too many people. But that is the nature of things, and who are we to question so fundamental a matter? Effective curls require an awareness of the biceps anatomy and a willingness to diverge from the conventional wisdom regarding technique. The biceps muscle is one of the many muscles of the body that crosses two joints. Technically, this muscle is the biceps brachii, or arm biceps, which is distinct from the biceps femoris, one of the hamstring muscles. Like its partner, the triceps, the biceps crosses both the elbow and shoulder joints and therefore causes movement to occur around both joints. The chin-up uses a combination of elbow flexion and shoulder extension, but so does a pull-up, the difference being the prone versus supine grip. The elbow flexion during the pull-up is performed without much biceps involvement, while the biceps are heavily involved in the chin-up. The difference is due to the anatomy of the elbow. The distal end of the biceps attaches to the radius, the shorter of the two forearm bones, at a point called the radial tuberosity, located on the posterior and medial aspects of the radius when the forearm is pronated. Supination is the term given to the position in which the hand is rotated forward and the palm is up. In the palm up position of the hand is referred to as supine. The forearm supinates when the biceps attachment on the radius rotates inward and upward as the muscle shortens. In fact, if the biceps are in full contraction, the hand is supine. The pull-up, performed with a prone grip, utilizes very little biceps and therefore proportionately more triceps and lats, while the chin-up uses lots of biceps. The elbow flexion part of the pull-up is accomplished by the other elbow flexors, the brachialis, the brachioradialis, and one of the smaller forearm muscles. The biceps also performs the movement known as shoulder flexion. Anatomical movement descriptions can sometimes be arbitrary, and flexion in the shoulder joint is defined as the forward and upward movement of the humerus. The biceps contributes to this movement because the proximal attachments, yes, there are two of them, thus the name biceps, are located on the anterior forward side of the scapula, the main bone of the shoulder joint. Because the tendon attachments cross the joint, the muscle moves the joint, and shoulder flexion is therefore a biceps function. Elbow flexion, along with shoulder extension, is used whenever anything is grasped and pulled toward the body. This is why chin-ups and pull-ups are such functional exercises. They duplicate this very normal motion under a load. In fact, elbow flexion is normally accompanied by shoulder extension. This is the way the arm is designed to work, and this is why elbow flexion with an immobile shoulder requires special equipment. The preacher curl was invented for the purpose of providing a way to work the distal biceps function in isolation. The isolation of a single muscle group that moves a single joint seldom contributes significantly to other more complex movements which include that muscle group. Remember that our definition of functional exercise is a normal human movement that can be performed under a scalable, increasable load. By this definition, no exercise that requires a machine or a specific device to perform it can be a functional exercise. Now, we're not including the barbell or the power rack in the specific device category here, since we can't limit our training to the use of sticks and rocks. And if a muscle is isolated in an exercise, its tendon attachments are too. This fact has a bearing on the injury-causing potential of these types of exercises. Examples of shoulder flexion in supination are harder to find, since raising things overhead is generally accomplished with a prone hand and a pressing motion that relies primarily on the deltoids and triceps. Shoulder flexion with a supine forearm pretty much exclusively occurs during exercise. But since the biceps do perform this function, it should be incorporated into biceps training so that this function gets worked. Curls should involve shoulder flexion because they can involve shoulder flexion. Barbell curls allow for both elbow flexion and shoulder flexion. They utilize a normal function of the arms and they do not require specialized equipment, again, the bar being considered non-specialized. So, barbell curls could be considered a functional exercise in the strict sense of the definition. There are as many ways to do curls as there are bodybuilding authors. If you're going to spend time doing all these variations, you've missed the point of this book. Let's assume you haven't, and that you want the best way to work the most biceps in the least time. That way is the standing barbell curl, done with a standard Olympic bar. It is performed standing, since it cannot be performed seated, and it is best done out of the rack, set at the same height that it would be for the press. Approach the bar with a supine grip, with the width varying between somewhat closer than shoulder width and several inches wider. The wider the grip, the greater the degree of supination that will be required to maintain that grip. The greater the supination, the more biceps will be contracted at full flexion. Depending on individual flexibility, a grip just wider than the shoulders will allow the full effects of the exercise to be expressed. This will be about the same grip used for the chin-up for all the same reasons. This version of the barbell curl starts at the top with your elbows in full flexion, as opposed to the more common method of starting at the bottom with extended elbows. When the bar is lowered to full extension and then raised back into flexion without a pause at the bottom, the biceps get the benefit of utilizing a stretch reflex to contract harder, thereby allowing the use of more weight. Breathing is done only at the top with none of the supportive pressure released at the bottom. The elbows are kept against the rib cage and start from a position in front of the bar. The barbell curl, like the good morning, intentionally uses a bar path that deviates from the midfoot balance point. You lower the weight eccentrically in an arc away from your body And in doing so, you create moment arms between the bar and your elbows, between the bar and your shoulders, and between the bar and the midfoot, so that you are intentionally manipulating the mechanics of the system to create the resistance. Keep your elbows against your ribs in front of the mid-axial line that separates front from back. As your elbows get almost straight at the bottom of the curl, they'll slide back into a position just behind this line. The elbows never straighten completely, because doing so would mean the tension is off the biceps, but they get close. Some tension is needed to initiate the concentric flexion that comprises the essence of this movement, and perfectly straight elbows make this hard and inefficient. Start the upward phase of the curl by sliding your elbows forward as you move the bar up in the same arc that it moved in on the way down. Elbows stay against the ribs the whole way up. This keeps the hands in supination by maintaining the supine position of the forearm. A good cue for this position is to think about pushing the medial pad of the palm, the part just above the wrist on the little finger side of your hand, into the bar, as if this were the only part of the hand in contact with the bar. You'll need to keep your wrists in a neutral position, neither flexed nor extended, but in a position that keeps the metacarpal bones of the hand in line with the forearm. Drive the bar back up to the starting position, keeping your hands supine and your elbows on your ribs. During this upward phase, your elbows will move forward to return to their position in front of the bar, producing shoulder flexion in addition to elbow flexion. It's common to see the elbows leave the rib cage and assume a position in line with, or maybe even outside, the hands on the bar, internal rotation of the humerus. This error involves the deltoids in the movement and it reduces the biceps' involvement. Keep your elbows close to your ribs while you externally rotate and make them slide forward on the way up. During the curl, it will be very difficult to maintain a perfect upright posture if you use any weight at all. The lifter barbell system must be in balance over the middle of the foot, which means that as the body moves forward through its arc, the body must balance the mass of the bar by leaning back a little bit. The heavier the weight, the more the lean. It is neither necessary, desirable, nor possible to try to stay strictly upright during a heavy barbell curl. If you're training for strength, you must use heavier weights, and you'll find that the physics of placing a heavy bar in front and your body in back cannot be circumvented. Do not flex or extend your knees at all, or let an excessive amount of upward movement out of the bottom be initiated by the hips instead of the elbows. Excessive is a judgment call. Once again, we see why some exercises are ancillary. Cheat curls are a legitimate exercise, depending on what you want out of the movement. If a heavy weight is started with a little hip extension and finished with a substantial amount of unassisted elbow and shoulder flexion, the cheat curl is probably legit. But if you start it with your hips and knees and then dive under the bar to receive it in full elbow flexion, you're doing a reverse grip clean, defeating the purpose of the exercise, risking several injuries, and inviting the criticism of more experienced and more disciplined lifters in the gym. Triceps exercises. Most of the triceps work that gets done in gyms all over the world is performed on some type of cable device. In most cases, the common triceps press down is the exercise of choice, being the one most frequently seen in magazines and exercise books and being the easiest to do while looking in the mirror. But the simple press down only works the distal triceps function, elbow extension, and ignores the fact that the triceps crosses both the shoulder and the elbow, and therefore has a proximal function as well. Shoulder extension is the proximal function, and the most efficient triceps exercises incorporate both functions. Cable press downs can be done in this manner, but they have an interesting limitation. As you get stronger, you'll eventually be able to use enough weight that your feet cannot stay in good contact with the floor. There is a better triceps exercise, one that is so effective at building lockout strength for the bench press that Larry Pacifico called it the fourth power lift. It is the lying triceps extension, or the LTE, done on a flat bench with a supine position with heavy weights. Done correctly, it is safe, brutally hard, and very effective for general upper body strength, with an emphasis on the triceps. Done the way many foolish people do it, as the famous skull crusher, it loses much of its effectiveness and all of its safety. The preferred equipment for the LTE is the Easy Curl Bar, a cambered bar intended for doing curls as an alternative to using a straight bar. The Easy Curl was invented back in the early 1970s by some poor bastard who probably didn't make a dime off the thing. It apparently ended up with one of the big magazine publishers who also happened to sell equipment and who started marketing it as his own device. Typical situation. The problem is that the Easy Curl bar doesn't work nearly as well for curls and for recruiting biceps contraction as a straight bar does. As we discussed earlier, the degree of supination of the forearm and hand directly affects the amount of biceps in contraction. The Easy Curl bar does, in fact, take the stress of supination off of the wrists and elbows, but it does so at the expense of a good biceps contraction. The camber of the bar is specifically intended to decrease the supination of the forearm, and anything less than a full supination results in less than complete biceps contraction. But the Easy Curl bar works perfectly for the lying triceps extension. The triceps is composed of three bundles of muscles, which originate on the humerus and the scapula and share a common insertion point on the olecranon process of the elbow. The lateral and medial heads of the triceps originate on the humerus and the long head originates on the scapula. The angle of the hand on the bar makes no difference in the quality of the triceps contraction. The more prone grip afforded by the Easy Curl bar is more comfortable for this exercise and does not reduce its effectiveness. The thing that distinguishes the lying triceps extension from other triceps exercises is the inclusion of the proximal function of the triceps, where the design of the movement produces shoulder extension using the long head of the muscle as well as elbow extension. It also includes the lats, some pec, coastal muscle, and abdominal involvement, and the forearms. This exercise dramatically increases the number of other muscles activated and is the first choice when you are adding a triceps assistance exercise to your program. The lying triceps extension, like the bench press, requires a spotter at heavy weights. Take a position on the bench with the top of your head just past the edge of the pad. Receive the bar from the spotter who has deadlifted it into position, handed it to you, and stepped back out of the way. The Easy Curl bar has three angles in the middle. Take your grip on the inside most angle with your palms prone, facing up, and the middle bend of the bar facing down. Your elbows will be pointed down the bench in external rotation, and the bar will be locked out over your shoulder joints, just as in the bench press. Your chest should be up, butt in contact with the bench, feet in a stable position on the floor, and eyes looking at the ceiling for the whole rep. Unlock your elbows while keeping your upper arms vertical, letting the bar arc backward behind your head and toward the floor. When your elbows get to about 90 degrees, let your shoulders rotate back to drop the bar down just above your head, touching your hair, down to about the level of the bench. This motion will stretch your triceps, deltoids, and lats. And when the bar is just below the level of the back of your head, let the stretch turn the rep around and start it back up. Pull the bar back up with your elbows as they approach the top. Extend them to lock out the bar in the start position. Keep the bar as close to the top of your head as possible while stretching down to the bench. And lead up with the stretch reflex, like you're throwing the bar at the ceiling and using your elbows to start the throw. The stretch reflex adds a lot of range of motion and power if you move explosively to the movement, making the lying triceps extension much more useful than the standard skull crusher. If you keep your elbows too straight and let the bar go back too far away from the top of your head, you lose some of the range of motion around the elbows. A big breath at the top inflates the chest and makes the stretch reflex at the bottom more effective. When the LTE is done in this way, both shoulder extension and elbow extension are used, and more triceps mass is stressed over a longer range of motion. Do sets of 10 to 15 reps with this exercise. Barbell training. There's just no substitute